A History of Moral Thought, Lecture 5, Being Good and Being Happy, The Republic.
This lecture is called Being Good and Being Happy. It's on Plato's Republic. Like Jesus and Buddha, Socrates wrote nothing. All we know about him comes from the fortunate fact, whether by chance or divine providence, that one of his disciples happened to be the greatest writer in the history of philosophy. His name was Plato. In 40 years of teaching philosophy, I have never found a better way to sell it to beginners than through Plato, because Plato makes philosophy two things that it usually isn't in classrooms, poetic and dramatic. Before he met Socrates, Plato was a dramatic poet, and he hoped to compete in the same dramatic competitions that won fame and fortune for Aeschylus and Sophocles. But then he met Socrates and had something like a religious conversion, a life-changing experience. He publicly burned all his poetries and dramas, and he devoted all his energy to writing up the Conversations of Socrates. By the way, nobody knows how much of these conversations came from the real Socrates and how much from Plato, but Plato always remained a faithful disciple of Socrates. Philosophy was meant to be that kind of life-changing thing in the ancient world. Imagine some ancient philosopher, anyone, make it Socrates himself. Imagine this philosopher transported to our time in a time machine. He would probably ask whether we had philosophers in our culture, and he would be told that yes, there are professional scholars in philosophy departments in universities. Well, I think Socrates would laugh at that, or maybe weep. Philosophy, a department? He would say, do you have love departments too, and life departments, and truth departments? Philosophy was not a department to Socrates and Plato. It was a way of life. The word means the love of wisdom, not a scholarly specialization. And professional? Selling wisdom for money? I think Socrates would call me an intellectual prostitute, and Boston College my pimp. There's a nice parallel between Plato and St. Augustine some 800 years later. Both were great poets, and both converted from poetry to philosophy, and both said some very negative things about poetry in their philosophy. But neither one could burn up the poet in his heart, even though Plato burned the poetry he put on paper. Both are as far from dull academic jargon as you could possibly get. Both sing philosophy. It's worth learning Greek just to read Plato, and it's worth learning Latin just to read Augustine. Plato also shows the truth as well as tells it. He's dramatic. Showing rather than telling is the secret of all good storytelling. His ideas are incarnated in concrete characters who interact psychologically as well as logically in his dialogues. He puts legs under his ideas. Ralph Waldo Emerson said, "Philosophy is Plato, and Plato is philosophy." And Alfred North Whitehead said, "The whole history of Western philosophy may be characterized quite accurately as a series of footnotes to Plato." Nearly every philosophical position anybody would take for the next 2,000 years can be found somewhere in one of Plato's dialogues, in the mouth of one of his characters. Plato wrote 30 dialogues, and The Republic is his masterpiece. It is the single most famous and influential book in the entire history of philosophy. And it is most centrally about ethics. Everyone thinks it's about politics, and it is, but only secondarily. It's about almost everything, metaphysics and anthropology and psychology and epistemology and education and history and religion and mythology and music. But its central point, the bottom line of all 10 books, all 400 pages, is a thesis in ethics, that justice is always more profitable than injustice. And what Plato means by justice, the Greek word is dike, is something much broader than what we mean by the word justice in English. It's almost the whole of ethics for Plato. It's the key virtue. The other virtues are parts of it. It meant not, first of all, getting your rights or giving people their rights. That was a kind of secondary connotation, but it meant right order, a kind of cosmic harmony or music. It was used even in astronomy for the cosmic order or the music of the spheres. When a Greek heard a word like dike, he felt somebody had just sung a beautiful note. When we hear the word justice, we feel like an accountant calculating debts and payments. In the Republic, politics is there as a means to the end of ethics. The politics is a mirror image of the ethics, because Plato believed that there was no double standard, that moral values for the state and moral values for the individual had to be the same pattern in two different places. And politics didn't mean in ancient Greece what it means today, something practical, something like a job. It was much more moral, much more idealistic. It was about the good life, the good community, the good communal life, and that meant the moral life. Politics was social ethics, and the polis didn't mean the bureaucratic state, but the human community, the society. Plato thought there had to be a common pattern to the good individual and the good community because communities are made only by individuals and made only of individuals and made for individuals. As Lincoln said, government is of the people, by the people, and for the people. Plato would have believed that too, even though he didn't believe in democracy, probably because a democracy had just executed Socrates, the wisest man in the world. The Republic contains 10 books. We would call them chapters. The first contains 3 different conversations about what justice is. Socrates converses first with Cephalus, an old man and a traditionalist, then Polemarchus, his son, a reasonable middle-aged man, and finally with Thrasymachus, a young man who is a sophist and a radical, a skeptic and a cynic. Socrates is looking for what justice is, essentially. He's looking for the essence of justice, not just a definition of the word, but a real definition, and a definition of what justice always is, everywhere, not just one of the many forms of it. Only when he has that can he have certainty about it. Well, first Cephalus says justice is paying your debts and telling the truth. But that definition won't work in all cases because it's not just to give back a weapon to a maniac. Polemarchus then says justice is giving people what they deserve. He identifies this with helping friends and harming enemies. But Socrates reminds him that we make mistakes and sometimes think of our enemies as our friends and think of our friends as our enemies. So Polemarchus improves the definition to helping true friends and harming true enemies, doing good to the good guys and bad to the bad guys. Socrates then criticizes this definition by saying something quite amazing, that justice should do good even to your enemies, to the bad guys. Because justice is a virtue, and virtue is good, and good can only do good, not harm, to everyone that it touches. Like Jesus, Socrates preached and practiced this, do good to those that hate you, love your enemies. At this point, Thrasymachus barges in, like an animal, and tries to bully Socrates. Thrasymachus's definition of justice is that it is whatever the strong man wants. Might makes right. Justice is only a mask painted on the face of power. The laws are made by the winners. For instance, if Germany had won World War II, Hitler would be the hero and Churchill would be the villain. Whatever the one who has the power to make the laws says is just, according to Thrasymachus. Most of the first book, and really the whole rest of the Republic, tries to refute Thrasymachus. And because Thrasymachus's philosophy is so familiar to us today, as we'll see later, it's almost exactly the philosophy of Machiavelli and also Nietzsche, it will be worth our while to look rather more deeply into it. The practical consequence of believing Thrasymachus's philosophy is quite radical. If justice is only a name for power, then it's naive and foolish to try to be just. Why not go to the root of the matter and go for the power? Thrasymachus's most important claim is that sometimes injustice is more profitable than justice. The good life, the happy life, is not the life of justice only. It's the life of justice when it works, and injustice when it works better. In other words, the end justifies the means. There is no moral absolute. Morality is just a set of words or ideals or values, something abstract in human minds. It's not real. This moral subjectivism or moral relativism was quite rare among the ancients, except among the Greek sophists, but it's far from rare among intellectuals in our culture. The teachers believe it more than the students. I mean, the teachers both in formal education and in informal education, what we call media. Opinion polls consistently reveal this morality gap between ordinary people, especially less educated people, and the intellectuals in our culture. In most ancient cultures, the teachers were more moralistic than their students. In our culture, it's the opposite. Thrasymachus writes the books today. We have to carefully distinguish, though, between two of Thrasymachus's claims. One of them is not very popular today, even among the intellectuals, and that's his identification of justice with power. That sounds much too much like crass totalitarianism. But the other claim is very popular, and that's his moral subjectivism, that morality is man-made. It happens by human social contract or by social consensus. It's not some universal, timeless, objective truth that we discover as we discover the laws of physics or the truths of mathematics. It's an art, like building bridges, or a game, like baseball. We make the rules, and therefore we can change them. And we can cheat, and sometimes cheating wins. That's Thrasymachus. Well then, what led men to create morality, according to Thrasymachus? And his answer is weakness. It must have been the weak, not the strong, who created moral law, especially the law of justice, of equality, of equal rights. Why would the strong man, who could get what he wanted by force, who was stronger and cleverer than others, lower himself to equality with others? So it's the majority who are weak who banded together to create laws of false, unnatural equality in order to tame the strong. That's where justice came from, says Thrasymachus. And the bottom line is that if that's so, there's no reason to be moral except fear of punishment. If you could get what you want by force, whether mental force or physical force, and if you could get away with it, why not? That's the simple question Plato is asking us through his character, Thrasymachus. Why not? It's a question I ask my students in ethics class. They all believe they shouldn't do anything morally wrong, so I ask them, why not? Well, because you'll be punished. Well, suppose you won't. Suppose you can get away with it. Well, because people will hate you. Well, suppose they won't. Suppose you can con them. Suppose your power includes propaganda, power over their minds. Or suppose you don't care what other people think. Why not do evil if you can get away with it and get what you want? Surprisingly, this is a question many of them have never thought about before, even though it's about the most simple and basic question in morality. And it's surprisingly hard to find the answer for them. Well, Socrates first shows Thrasymachus that he is contradicting himself. There are all sorts of logical self-contradictions in his definition of justice as power. That argument is long and abstract, and it doesn't really sink in too deeply, even if the logic is quite right. Thrasymachus can't refute Socrates, though, so he just goes home in a sulk. But Socrates is not satisfied. One of the other characters in the dialogue, Glaucon, who was Plato's brother, takes up Thrasymachus's position as devil's advocate, to see if Socrates can refute it better. Glaucon makes Thrasymachus's philosophy much more concrete and memorable by using a mythic image that was already old in Plato's day. No one knows its origin. This image was used again in the medieval Germanic story of the Nibelungs and by Richard Wagner in his great opera cycle that was based on that story. And finally, by the book which five separate opinion polls chose as the greatest book of the 20th century, Tolkien's The Lord of the Rings. It's the image of the Ring of Power. In Plato's story, Gyges, like Tolkien's Gollum, is a little man, a loser. He finds this magic ring that makes him a winner, he thinks, by giving him power. Both the power to do whatever he wants and the power to get away with it by becoming invisible. So he kills the king, marries the queen, rules the kingdom and cons the people. Isn't he happy? Isn't the ring the way to the happy life, the really good life, rather than sheepishly following the rules? Justice isn't the way to happiness, power is. If you were Gyges, wouldn't you use the ring? That's Glaucon's argument. He hopes Socrates can refute it. Tolkien, like Plato, says, no, it's not wise to use the ring. In The Lord of the Rings, the quest is not to get something, as in most quest stories, but to get rid of something, to get rid of that ring of power, because power corrupts. If Tolkien or Plato were Aladdin and found the lamp and rubbed it, and the genie came out and offered three wishes, I think both Tolkien and Plato would say as their wish number one, destroy the lamp. Now, everybody wants happiness. Not everybody wants justice, not everybody wants injustice, and not everybody wants power. So the question is, what gives you happiness? What means attains the end of happiness? Is it justice? Or is it injustice with the power to do whatever you want and get away with it? How shall we then live? That's what's at stake in the Republic. Most people aren't consistent enough or crass enough to totally embrace Thrasymachus's philosophy. But every time we think it's okay to cheat a little, or lie a little, or be unfaithful a little, we really do believe it. If we didn't believe that doing wrong was going to make us happy, we wouldn't do it. If sin didn't look like fun, we'd all be saints. So Plato's high aim in the Republic is to convince us that sin is never fun, injustice is never profitable, and to really convince us, not just give us a logical argument that we can't answer. So if Plato succeeds, this book is one of the most important books ever written. And I think that's the main reason why it's the most famous book in the history of philosophy. Whether it succeeds or not, its aim is so high. Well, it's certainly not the politics of the Republic that have made it famous. Its politics have never worked, and they contain all sorts of ridiculous things, which I won't even mention because we don't have the time and because I don't want to prejudice you against a great thinker by Plato by going over some of his stupidest ideas. Great philosophers can be very stupid politicians. Hegel thought the kingdom of God had come to earth with Bismarck's Prussia. Heidegger, perhaps the profoundest philosopher of the 20th century, joined the Nazi party and called Hitler the new god. Plato wasn't quite that stupid. The purpose of the Republic is to prove that justice is always more profitable than injustice, that being good must be the way to be happy. Now, the road to this goal has four steps for Plato. And Plato lays out these four steps in his Theory of Education in Books 6 and 7 of the Republic, where he uses the image of a line divided into four parts and then illustrates these four steps in the famous image of the prisoner escaping from the cave of ignorance. The first step is tradition and authority, accepting conventional opinions, others' ideas, just as your eyes accept images of things in the mirror or in pictures or reflections in the water without ever seeing those things yourself. The second step is seeing them yourself, personal experience with your own senses. The third step is logical reasoning, proving it. That in itself is not enough, though. You have to have a fourth step, which is wisdom, which is understanding it, understanding the essences, the natures of things. And in the Republic, the thing you're trying to understand is justice. Now, the Republic practices what it preaches. It goes through these four steps itself, beginning with Cephalus's conventional authoritarian definition of justice, then testing it with concrete examples from experience, like the madman with the weapon, and then moving up to logical reasoning, showing Polemarchus and Thrasymachus that their definitions have logical self-contradictions in them. And that's how Book 1 ends. But Socrates is not satisfied because Step 4 is missing, the understanding of the essence of justice. Once we know that, we will see why justice must be more profitable than injustice. We will have certainty. That's the goal of the rest of the Republic. So here is Plato's strategy. We want to really prove that justice must always be more profitable than injustice, and we want to reach certainty on this. so we need to know their essences, which means simply what justice and injustice really are. We need to know what we're talking about. We need real definitions, not just verbal definitions. How do we find them? Well, justice and injustice exist in two places, in individual souls and in states. Justice in the soul is the thing Plato's primarily concerned to find, but that's also the hardest kind of justice to find because souls are smaller than states and invisible. But if there's a common essence of justice in both places, then we will first try to find this essential nature or pattern of justice and injustice in the state, where it's easier to see, and then we'll see if we can find the same pattern in individual souls, which are harder to see. Like reading a large print book first, and then reading the same text in small print. So Plato begins with the history of the rise of justice in the state through the growth of the just state. Plato believes the state is natural and not artificial. He says it naturally arises from the fact of specialization. Different people are good at different things. So even in the most primitive community, one man farms for everybody, one builds for everybody, one hunts for everybody, and they exchange their products. And this efficiency in specialization creates wealth, and soon there is extra wealth, luxuries. And they invent money as a means of exchange, and some get richer than others, so a police or a military class is needed to stop robberies inside the state once there is this surplus wealth to rob, and to defend the state, once it gets rich, from neighboring states who want to conquer it and steal its riches. But the police are not necessarily wise. They need somebody to supervise them. They need wise legislators. So these three classes naturally evolve in the state, corresponding to the three natural functions: the producers of wealth, the supervisors, the keepers of order, and the rulers, the legislators. So you have the law abiders, the law enforcers, and the law makers. The producers are the masses. The other two classes, though they have authority over them, rule for their sake. They exist for the people. Each of the three classes needs a virtue, a good habit, in order to do its job well. The producers need moderation, because they deal with material things, and there's always excess or defect possible, too much or too little of anything. What the soldiers need above all is courage, and what the legislators need above all is wisdom. So where is justice? It's not in any one of these three classes, but in the harmonious functioning of all three, when each does its proper business with its proper virtue. So justice is, in a community, what health is in a body. The harmonious functioning of all the organs together. A just society is one with wisdom and courage and moderation. Now, these three classes in Plato's community correspond to something perennial, something natural, because every developed society in history seems to have at least these three groups within them, with these three functions. The details of Plato's political philosophy haven't lasted much, but this basic structure has. Plato then looks for this same pattern in the individual soul, and he finds it by making the world's first clear map of the soul, the world's first psychology. He begins with the experience of an inner conflict between the desires which want something and the reason which sometimes contradicts the desires. The conflict is decided by a third mediating power, which we would call the will, and Plato calls the spirited part, which sides with either the reason or the desires. And a just soul, a spiritually healthy soul, is like a just state, one where the three powers do their job with their proper virtue. And Plato finds the need for the same four basic virtues in the soul that he found in the state. Wisdom is needed by the mind or reason, which is like the inner legislator. Courage is needed in the will, the spirited part, which is like the inner soldier. And moderation is needed in the desires, which are like the inner producers. And justice is the harmony of all three, each doing its proper job. These four basic virtues have been called the four cardinal virtues ever since Plato. And nearly every psychology since Plato's has inherited something like his threefold structure. For instance, Freud's id, ego, and superego correspond roughly to Plato's desires, will, and reason. Now that he has found justice in the soul and in the state, he has to find injustice too, so he can compare the two. But there's a long digression in the middle of the Republic about who would rule the just state. Plato says the best rulers would be philosophers. In fact, that's his central concrete prescription for utopia. He writes, "Until philosophers become kings, or kings become philosophers, we will have no rest from troubles in the world." Now, that sounds so ridiculous that he has to define what he means by a philosopher. And, no surprise, it turns out to be a description of Socrates. The philosopher is the one who can rise to that fourth level of education and know the essences of things, like justice. That's what's expressed in definitions, answers to the question, what is it? The kind of question Socrates is always asking. This abstract theoretical wisdom is the key to practical ethical goodness for Plato. Because if you succeed in knowing what justice and injustice essentially are, then you can be certain that justice will always be more profitable than injustice, that moral virtue will always make you happy, then you'll be virtuous because you always want to be happy. The reason we choose vice instead of virtue is that we're not certain that virtue will make us happy. So we try both experiments, a little virtue and a little vice. Now, the only way we can be certain about virtue and vice is by understanding the essence of both. You're certain that a square can't be a circle because you understand the essence of a square and the essence of a circle, but you're probably not absolutely certain that a quasar can't be an angel because you don't fully understand the essence of a quasar or an angel. But in order to be certain that justice is always more profitable than injustice, you have to first understand exactly what justice and injustice are. You have to understand these universal essences. So for Plato, that's the bottom line practical payoff for philosophy, the knowledge of essences. And that's why he wants the philosopher to rule the state, the Socratic philosopher who knows the essence of justice and injustice. Or if he doesn't know them, at least he knows he has to search for them. Now, there are hundreds of details in Plato's picture of the just state, and some of them are simply silly, like his notion of relations between the sexes. He says both that there's no difference between men and women, and that men are superior to women at everything. So he's both a radical left-wing unisexist and a radical right-wing male chauvinist. But two of the details deserve mention: education and music. Plato says the single most important thing in the state is education. Plato literally invented university education. He founded the world's first university, the Academy. We're in one of these Platonic inventions right now, made of metal instead of buildings, but this is education. And even though education hasn't brought us utopia and it hasn't solved all the problems in the world, we would be much more like barbarians without it. So we're all profoundly indebted to Plato. And the first and most powerful kind of education, says Plato, is music. He spends a whole book of the Republic on music and only one paragraph on economics. Music is tremendously powerful, he says, because it's the first thing that puts order or disorder into your soul before you can understand language and reason. And even when you're an adult, it gets into your soul without passing the guard at the gate of reason. It's like water that can seep under castle walls, no matter how strong they are. And it connects you with the patterns of harmony in the whole cosmos, the music of the spheres, and it makes you happy by this harmony. And justice is a form of harmony, a higher form, so music is a powerful training in morality. Justice is the key virtue for Plato, and contains the other three cardinal virtues. So if you know justice, you know wisdom and courage and moderation too. And the other virtues depend on these four. They're less than these four. But there's also something even greater than these four, even greater than justice. And Plato says that's goodness itself, the Platonic idea of the good. A Platonic idea is not an idea in anybody's mind, but the eternal essence, the eternal truth known by a mind. We've just defined justice in the Republic, but Plato says we can't define the idea of the good because it's infinite. It's like God. Or rather, it's like the nature of God without the person. Absolute perfection. A perfect ideal. Plato can't define this absolute ideal, but he can say something about it by parables and analogies, rather like Jesus when he talks about God the Father and the kingdom of God. Plato says the good is like the sun. You can't stare at the sun without going blind. You can't see the sun directly, but it's only by the sun's light that you see everything else. So you can't know the absolute good as you can know finite definable things like justice, but it's only by that light that you can know whatever you know. The sun is not a lit object, but the origin of light, and the absolute good is not intelligible, not humanly knowable or definable, but it is the origin of all intelligibility, all order, both physical and spiritual. Everything is intelligible ultimately by its purpose, its design, its end, what it is good for. Plato's most famous parable is the parable of the cave. It's a story of the steps of the philosopher's education. I won't summarize it or interpret it because you've got to read this for yourself. It's the single most famous thing any philosopher in history has ever written. You should be ashamed of yourself if your home doesn't have a copy of Plato's dialogues or if you've never read a page of Plato. If you read nothing else, read the first few pages of Book 7 of the Republic, The Parable of the Cave. Plato then goes on to define injustice, both in the state and in the soul. He finds four forms of injustice in both places based on the natural order being upset, the natural rule or hierarchy being turned upside down. There are five forms of government, he says, one just form and four unjust forms. First, aristocracy means rule by the best. Aristos means the best, not necessarily the richest. Timocracy is the next best, that's the rule by the brave, the soldier class. Then comes plutocracy, or oligarchy, rule by the rich few among the masses. And then democracy, which is the rule of the masses, which Plato identifies with anarchy. Plato seems to have no idea of a complex legal representative democracy like ours, a rule of law rather than a rule of arbitrary will. The only democracy he knew was the rule by the anarchic, passionate mob that had voted for the death of Socrates. Finally, worst of all is tyranny, when the dictator comes in to restore order after the chaos of democracy. That's another reason Plato didn't like democracy. He thought it led to dictatorship. Now, each of these four regimes below aristocracy is not good or happy or profitable because it's not natural. The natural order is perverted. The same is true of the unjust regimes in the soul. The just soul is one ruled by reason. Reason meant intelligence and wisdom, first of all. The four kinds of unjust soul are ruled by the will, which corresponds to the soldiers, or the elite few desires, which corresponds to the rich among the producers, or by all the desires in chaos, which corresponds to the masses, or finally by the inner tyrant of obsession and an addiction to power. And since obviously none of these states of soul is profitable or happifying, we can see that justice must always be more profitable than injustice. We can see this. We don't need to rely only on our trust in tradition or authority, that's step one of Plato's educational scheme, or our own ever-changing sense experience, that's step two, or clever logical reasoning, that's step three, but we can see it. We can see that the soul of the unjust man is like a zoo, where the animals rule the zookeeper. Thus, Plato proves that justice must always be more profitable than injustice. So, what's wrong with Plato's argument? Why hasn't everyone who reads the Republic become so convinced of Plato's conclusion that they become instant saints? That's the most practical question, I think. There are two possible answers. First, there may be something wrong with Plato's argument. Or second, there may be nothing wrong with Plato's argument, but maybe argument itself isn't good enough to make you good. In other words, maybe there's something missing in Plato's psychology. Maybe we're darker and more irrational than Plato thought. Maybe we can fully understand with certainty that justice makes us happy, and nevertheless we can choose injustice instead. That sounds ridiculous, but think, the last time you did something bad, was it only an intellectual mistake? Didn't you know perfectly well that this was not going to make you happy, that you would regret it later, but you did it anyway? Plato had asked that question in the earlier dialogue, the Meno, whether virtue could be taught, assuming it was knowledge. The Republic was his attempt to answer that question by doing it, by teaching virtue, both what it was and why it was always profitable. But maybe he was wrong there. Maybe the way we get virtue is not by teaching. Maybe we get it by the second way he mentions in the Meno, by practice. That was Aristotle's answer. Aristotle was Plato's greatest pupil, as Plato was Socrates' greatest pupil. And Aristotle set up the world's second university, the Lyceum, after Plato died. Out of respect for Plato, he waited until his master died to rival him. In the Lyceum, Aristotle taught a much more practical and commonsensical philosophy, less mystical, less abstract, less purely intellectualistic. Aristotle is to Western civilization what Confucius has been to Chinese civilization, the paragon of common sense. Most people are Aristotelians, whether they know it or not. On almost every issue, Aristotle is the philosopher of common sense, of ordinary opinions, of a mean or medium between extremes, and of the practical person. Next time we'll look at his book Nicomachean Ethics, which he wrote for his nephew Nicomachus. Next to Plato's Republic, it's probably the most famous and well-read book of ethical philosophy in the world.
This ends Lecture 5.